Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's broadcast. We're coming to you this evening from Nottingham. Nottingham because we're with James Booth, who, as you may remember, was the BOA's first spinal fellow at the Queen's Medical Centre in their spinal unit, and has been there now since 2011. That was a year's fellowship. He's now the consultant spinal osteopath with the spinal unit there. James, it's a great pleasure to see you again. The Academy's broadcast. It's the first. You've done a podcast with us before, haven't you?
I have, yes.
This is the first broadcast.
Yep.
I think it's worth us starting this off by talking about the osteopathic fellowship at the centre, first of all, because it runs every year, I believe. It's a fantastic opportunity, but I suspect that a lot of people will think of it as being quite daunting.
Yeah, and certainly that's how I felt when I first did it. But I think it's good for us to scare ourselves as well every now and then and do something which is challenging and step out of the comfort of our own private practice and to try and look at opportunities, A, to develop ourselves, but also to try and develop the profession. And that's what the fellowship really gives us, a unique and fantastic opportunity to do.
Yeah. How do they select the fellows? It's the IO that does it.
The Institute of Osteopathy fund the fellowship, so it's a paid position for 1 year based on 2 days a week. And basically it's open to application from any osteopath who's registered with the General Osteopathic Council in this country. Applications will be opening within the next month, I think. They're submitted to the IO. We then shortlist the candidates based on their covering application letter and their CV, and thereafter the shortlist are invited to an open day at the Queen's Medical Centre to come and see how things go at in the spinal unit and how we work, and then further shortlisted down to the final three or four candidates who are interviewed by a panel for the position. And it's a fantastic opportunity, and it may seem daunting, but it's certainly something that we would encourage people to try and do because it's a unique opportunity to get.
What are the characteristics they're looking for when they shortlist people and interview them?
Primarily somebody who's prepared to learn, who's willing to learn. We don't want somebody coming into the post who thinks that because they've been in practice a while and have done some CPD that they've kind of reached the end of their learning. So it's about being open-minded. Communication is a crucial trait to have, an ability to communicate across the professions, not just for the other osteopaths, but we work in a team of spinal surgeons, we work very closely with physiotherapy colleagues, and with medical practitioners broadly based across the hospital, including rheumatology and sports medicine and pain management. So it's having an ability to communicate effectively with all of those sorts of professionals. There's also, it's crucial that whoever comes into the position is prepared to throw absolutely everything into it. It's 1 year of intensive learning. And I'm sure if you speak to Sam Morris, who's a current fellow, you know, he'll let you know that there's a fair amount of work that goes into it. But it's very much the case, the more you put in, the more you get out.
So when you say there's a hell of a lot of learning, presumably the fellows are practicing while they're at the hospital?
The way it tends to work is that the fellow will spend roughly, of the 2 days a week, they'll spend 1 day a week with me in clinic treating patients. And we have a unique set of patients in that most of them have had some sort of spinal surgery or spinal intervention, whether it be injection therapy or pain medication. Many of them have had physiotherapy and failed. Quite a lot of them have had osteopathy and chiropractic and have failed treatment as well. They're all chronic, they're all complex, they have a number of psychological overlays on top of their chronic pain, so we have a lot of patients with yellow flags, and they're a really unique bunch of patients who you don't generally get to see many of in private practice, so you see a high volume of them and get to treat a number of them on the 1 day that you're with me. And then on the other day, the intention is that you go around the hospital spending time with colleagues who refer into our service, be that our pain management colleagues, sports medicine, or surgical colleagues. And it's an opportunity to see how they go about assessing and managing patients with chronic and complex spinal conditions.
How much do you think those colleagues get from the experience?
A lot. Certainly the feedback that we get from our colleagues is that overwhelmingly, they're impressed with what we do. they're impressed with what we're able to.
Sorry, is that, to interrupt, is that osteopaths or is that the osteopaths and physios? Because there are physios doing the same thing, aren't
they? Well, but they're familiar with physiotherapy because they've grown up in the NHS surrounded by physios. So, no, specifically with osteopaths, because a lot of them don't really know a great deal about osteopathy or what osteopaths do. So they are, they're very impressed with what they do. The feedback that I get from colleagues like surgeons and pain management consultants is that they feel that we add huge value to the service, that we deliver a component of spinal pain management which nobody else is able to deliver. And so overwhelmingly, it's a very positive response to our fellows spending time with them.
Does that, when somebody says something like that, it always comes as a bit of a surprise to me, because I think to myself, well, why isn't anyone else doing what we do? Because most of us think of it as being fairly simple, logical, obvious physical medicine. So your physiotherapy colleagues, and I'm sorry we couldn't get Ellie in here today because we had a splendid chat with her on one of the osteoblasts. But you know, she can do the same things that you can, surely.
She can, in as much as, I mean, you know, some of our physio colleagues, like Ellie, have done a master's degree in manual therapy. So they recognize the importance of manual therapy, they recognize the value of it, but they have to combine that with all of the treatment modalities and options that they offer as physiotherapists. Yeah. So movement control training and education and exercise and psychological therapies and all the other aspects of physiotherapy that they have to offer. And that's just within those physios who are treating spinal patients, let alone the patients who have been seen for respiratory and vascular and all the other types of conditions. So they are able to do some manual therapy, but they don't do it exclusively the way that we do. And so,
when you say manual therapy, do you mean what osteopaths would call
hands-on treatment, whether that be soft tissue, mobilizing, articulating, manipulating, all of those sorts of all of the aspects of manual therapy, broadly speaking, which we spend all of our time doing, and it means that we are better at it because we do a lot more of it. And also, if we're doing that all of the time, why have a physio who does a bit of it trying to do it when we're there and we can do a lot of it? And in the same respect, you know, I may do a little bit of exercise prescription for the patients, but by and large, I'll get physio colleagues to come in and assess a patient for exercise prescription and for the most appropriate type of exercise.
It sounds like the relationship between you and the other physios, I presume there are
a number
of your unit.
It's a big team of physios.
It's quite good.
It's very good. We have a very close relationship.
But you're the only osteopath other than the current spinal fellow.
That's right. Yeah. And the strength of the relationship lies in the confidence that we have in what we do. The physios are very confident about what they do. They're very happy with what they're able to offer. And as are we. And nobody sees, the physios don't see us as stepping on their toes or cutting across them and the same the other way around. And that's the important part about working as a team. It's about not only recognizing what you can do, but also recognizing what other people can do better than you.
Yeah, it does sound as though the physios in your unit are a different caliber of practitioner than some of the people about whom we hear within the NHS, because very often, and of course we only hear the bad stories because otherwise they wouldn't be coming to us, very often we hear that patients go to see a physio on the NHS and all they get is the exercises out of the box and told to go away. And I have seen contracts where that's all they're allowed to do.
Yeah.
Whereas if they go and see a private physiotherapist, then they get much more manual therapy rather than simply have some exercises.
I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Certainly the patients who we see in the hospital who have been through physiotherapy have largely been through physiotherapy in the community. And as you say, sometimes contractually they are obliged only to offer exercise. They don't do any hands-on treatment. Or sometimes that's the extent of their scope of practice. So when they come to see us, we're a specialist secondary spinal care unit. We're one of the foremost spinal care units in Europe. So you'd expect that we would have good physios who are good at what they do, and they are. And so the patients who come to us who've had physio in the community that hasn't worked for them should expect a higher standard of physiotherapy.
Yeah.
And to some extent, the patients who I see who've had some osteopathic or chiropractic treatments in the community where it's failed, and they do well with us. They do well with us because we are used to dealing with patients who have chronic pain, who have complex pain, and often have had surgery and other interventions which have failed, and so we know how to manage that particular subgroup of patients in the same way that an osteopath in the community who's very used to dealing with acute patients might do better than I would with them.
And I suppose that given that your patients are generally chronic, waiting times are not an issue for the spinal unit.
Well, they're not an issue in terms of their pain isn't getting any worse while they're waiting. They are an issue in the sense that the patients aren't happy to wait for as long as they often do. And, you know, my waiting list at the moment is around about 6 or 7 months
for
an appointment. So when a patient is referred to me, there is a fairly long wait, unfortunately. But that partly reflects the demand on our service.
Yeah.
When I took over in 2012, in the subsequent year, we increased our capacity by 75%. But our waiting times went from 3 months up to 7 months. So despite the amount of effort that we're putting into to seeing patients and more patients, the demand goes up because those who refer into our service are seeing the value of it and are wanting to make use of the service.
Yeah. How often are you seeing the patients generally?
They generally get a course of between 10 and 12 treatments.
Okay.
Sometimes less, occasionally more, but by and large, the vast majority will be seen.
Which, of course, osteopaths in the community would think of as being a very long course of treatment, but obviously this is more to do with the chronicity of the problem.
It is to do with the chronicity of the problem, and also it's to do with the fact that, as I say, we often, as well as improving their mechanical function and overcoming their osteopathic issues, we then try and feed in some physiotherapy treatments, and we do some biopsychosocial treatments as well to help them with the psychological overlay of their problems.
And dare I ask, I mean, the all-important question for the NHS, do they see this as being cost-effective?
We haven't done a cost-benefit analysis as yet. I mean, we collect a lot of data about our service, and we have good data based on 3 years' worth of treating these patients now. It's a very difficult thing to work out because healthcare economics is a complex subject, and finding a healthcare economist is a job in itself. But what we see is that certainly the patients who we treat have a much lower dependence on further intervention, investigation, often surgery and injection therapies. We know that according to our data, 43% of the patients we treat come off all of their medication, which they take for their spinal condition. And so when you start to look at that from a healthcare economics point of view, those patients are not only coming off their medication and therefore saving the cost of the medication, but all of the comorbidities associated with taking the medication.
Yeah. Yeah.
And often they return to work, they return to normal activities of daily living. And again, the cost-benefit analysis of that is quite complicated.
And without asking you to recall the specifics, I take it that now, after 4 or 5 years of being in your position, there, even since then, but probably from before then as well, there is a meaningful number in that research group.
The number is meaningful. It's not statistically powerful enough yet to publish data, but we're heading in that direction. But this kind of research is very, very difficult to get. Yeah. And we have this registry with near to 200 patients on it, but we've treated far more patients than that. The problem is that often patients towards the end of their treatment will stop coming for treatment because they're feeling better and are getting back to normal activity, and so you don't get the opportunity to collect data at the end of the course of treatment, or that the data collection tools that we use are very complex, so there's a lot of information coming in with scope for the data tools that are collecting the information to be incomplete, and so you can't use that whole data set. So you've treated a patient for 10 or 12 weeks, and because they haven't signed the paper when they've completed it on the last appointment, or because the date wasn't entered properly, you lose 12 weeks worth of data, which is shattering. So there are lots of reasons why we haven't got as big a data set as we'd like, and also this was a registry which we set up when we first started collecting the data 3.5 years ago.
Oh, so it's more recent than I thought then.
Yes. And
how long has the spinal unit itself been going? In its current sort of form?
With osteopathy?
No, I mean as a co...
I think roughly 25 years.
Right.
Before that it was part of what was called Harlow Wood, which was a hospital here in Nottingham, which doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And they were part of a more general orthopaedic service. Mm-hmm. And then a group of surgeons who were orthopaedic and neurosurgeons who specialised in spinal surgery decided to set up a specialist spinal unit. So Mike Grevitt and Hussein Mehdi and John Webb were three of the forerunners in spinal surgery in this country, and they set up this specialist spinal unit.
Okay. When's the next fellowship come up for grabs?
As I say, applications will be opening within the next month. We'll be having an open day in May, interviews in June, and the next fellow will start at the beginning of September.
It's kind of, the opportunity is kind of restricted, isn't it? Because if you're going to do 2 days a week in Nottingham, then you've pretty much got to be fairly close to Nottingham to do that, which is rather a shame. Is there any indication that other hospitals are going to follow suit in this regard, or do they need more powerful evidence from...
Well, that's part of the reason why we're doing the fellowship, is we want to try and populate other hospitals with osteopaths. Yeah. You know, the point about the travelling, Sam Morris, who's our current fellow, comes from Manchester.
Right.
So he drives...
Someone has to.
He drives down, cheerfully, from Manchester twice a week.
Yeah.
Sometimes he stays overnight and does two consecutive days. And it is a big commitment,
yeah.
But it's a rare opportunity. And, you know, we're looking for people who are committed to developing themselves and the profession. And that's what it requires.
It'd be fascinating. It'd be fantastic if we could get more of these things. But I suspect that the IO itself will be limited in the number that it could fund.
Yeah.
I take it that you're now funded by the NHS.
I'm employed by the NHS, by the trust that I work for. So, you know, there are financial constraints, and the IO are under a lot of pressure to produce evidence and to get good research. And it's hard fought and very difficult to come by. And so it takes a long time. And they've made a huge commitment to 5 years so far of the fellowship programme. And clearly, that you know, they don't have limitless finances and can't continue to support this. But we are exploring other options at the moment to try and continue the fellowship in the event that the IO can't continue to fund it.
We've got an interesting question, actually, which has come in, which is, what effect has it had on your private practice being established as the osteopathic consultant to such an eminent spinal unit? And that could mean... Does it affect your relationship with GPs? Has it been good for your marketing with general private patients?
Before I did the fellowship, I had a busy private practice anyway, and part of the reason I did the fellowship was because I'd been in private practice for 12 years, and I just felt like I needed a challenge and I needed a change. So it wasn't that I was going out looking for more patients. I was full pretty much five days a week. And so the instant challenge is I now spend 2.5 days a week at the hospital, which means I've got to cram 5 days worth of patients into 2.5 days. So that's one of the impacts it's had. In terms of my relationship with local GPs and spinal surgeons, it's certainly the case that GPs in the community now more readily make contact with me to ask my opinion on how to manage patients, ask on the best referral route, ask about medication, and I get more referrals from consultant colleagues at the hospital into my private practice.
Right. Well, that's quite encouraging, isn't it? And it makes it... in my practice, we've made a lot of effort to make contact with GPs. Having an NHS contract has really helped in that regard, because all of a sudden they can see an easy route to refer. And I guess subconsciously they feel that if the NHS recognises us, then we must be credible practitioners. But still there are GPs who will refuse to refer people to us for the most bizarre reasons.
I think it's often down to having a relationship.
Yeah.
And
so it's very hard to build that relationship with a GP, isn't it? Because they're too busy. You have to fight your way past the guardian, the practice manager or the receptionist, to build some sort of communication with the GP themselves. Then you've got to convince them that it's worth them paying attention to you. And I guess there's probably a little bit of suspicion that, rather like the old days when drug salesmen would come to the GP's door and flog them stuff which they could happily accept or refuse, I suppose. But the statistics show that if a drug salesman spoke to a GP, they were more likely to refer their drugs.
Sure.
They're not allowed to do that anymore. Maybe they think we're doing the same sort of thing. But one of the examples that I had is only recently we had a GP, and this is the patient's account, so I can't say if it's what the GP actually said. The patient went to the GP with a back problem, which in our area they are legitimately allowed to refer to us under the National Health Service. And the GP said, it's a muscular problem, I can't send you to an osteopath because they only treat bones. And I thought to myself, well, what do you think we do to a bone? There's not much you can do to a bone on its own, is there, other than cut it in half or nail it together again? So that limitation in their knowledge, it can only be assisted by more of people like you.
Absolutely right. And by us producing more evidence and publishing the evidence in the right sort of journals so that they're reading it. But
we're going to come back to that later.
But I think the other thing is, this is about credible communication. Yeah. So if you communicate with a GP, and if you write to a GP and say a patient is presented with symptoms X, Y, and Z, would you mind carrying out blood tests, for example, to check their B12 and folate, if you suspected there was a peripheral neuropathy? If you said you had some concerns about potential red flags, would they investigate that? And sometimes it's about communicating with patients what you are aware of, but also the types of treatment that you do. I mean, I used to write letters to GPs saying, you know, I've seen this patient, this is the treatment that I've provided, they haven't benefited or made progress, and I suspect we ought to investigate this a little further. The GP reading the letter can see what treatment I offer.
Yes.
So sometimes it's about credible communication. Yeah. But more often than not, it's just about sometimes picking the phone up and phoning the GP and saying, I'm a little bit concerned about this patient. This is what I've done. This is what I've found. Would you mind checking this, that, or the next thing? Yeah. And over time, it does take time, but you can build up a relationship with GPs. Because at the end of the day, patients with musculoskeletal pain present GPs with a headache because they need to have something to offer the patient. And if you give them a solution, you know, they're not going to turn their back on you. If you give them a credible solution and an option for management of those patients, that's what they're looking for.
Yes. We've had a comment come in, and just to reiterate, your comments are anonymous, so I apologise, I'm not being rude by not giving your name. I genuinely don't know who sends these things in. But this viewer has just said it's also political, and that they work in two GP practices, and out of the seven partners, four refer and the rest don't, because they don't agree with private medicine.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for them, but I work within the spinal unit. We have 8 consultant spinal surgeons, and 5 of them refer patients to me and 3 of them don't.
Yes.
And that's nothing to do with private medicine. They'll always find a reason not to do it. And, you know, they may say that it's private medicine, or they may say that it's you only deal with bones, or it may be that, you know, they don't like your mother-in-law. They'll always find some reason. If they are opposed to osteopathy, they'll find a reason to justify it. At the end of the day, we've got to break down those prejudices.
Yes. Of course, it's tempting to think that it's only osteopaths or maybe chiropractors that they're opposed to or prejudiced to, but it's quite possible that they don't refer to other conventional specialities as well.
I certainly hear of GPs saying they wouldn't refer anybody to an optician, they wouldn't refer anybody to a podiatrist, they wouldn't refer anybody to a physiotherapist, because some GPs, for whatever reason, take the view that if you're not medically trained, you're not competent and capable of making a diagnosis and managing a patient.
As far as they're concerned, medically trained means the same training they had.
Exactly. Exactly.
There was, I think I'm right in saying that recently, and I heard this on Radio 4, so it must be true, there was an argument that actually you don't need to be trained as a doctor to be an orthopod. If you're going to replace knees, you need to be trained to replace knees, and you don't need to go through the whole panoply of medical training to do that, which would be a radical departure from our conventional philosophy, wouldn't it? Obviously, I'm not saying you can just do it walking off the street and do a course in knees. You need to know quite a bit of physiology and some emergency medicine.
Well, you do, and certainly through dealing with spinal surgeons, I think without the medical training, they wouldn't be able to completely understand the patient the way they do, because when you have patients who come in with significant comorbidities, you often need to understand what those comorbidities are and what the implications of them might be. So simply replacing a knee is not just, you know,
I guess the rather radical idea was that there will be people who have that whole range of knowledge, but if they say, no, I think you need your knee replaced, go and see this person over here. That's what he does, and he's really good at it because that's all he does.
Yes.
Does it really, really well.
And that's certainly happening to some extent already in the hospital. I mean, we have dedicated spinal surgeons and we have dedicated knee surgeons and hip surgeons, but I think the reverse is happening to some extent as well, where the more straightforward and simple procedures that used to be carried out by consultant surgeons are now, like, for example, I do a spinal injection list once a week.
Yes.
Previously that was a procedure which was only carried out by somebody who's medically trained, but because of the training that I've gone through in the hospital I'm classified as an allied healthcare professional. I'm able to do spinal injections, and colleagues of mine do epidural injections. So there's also being a kind of a dissemination of responsibility and skills down to...
That must be opening some minds. That and the idea of having nurse practitioners as well, who've now got much greater
absolutely.
Range of skills than traditionally as a
yeah,
nurse's remit. And that hopefully will open up minds for the future in the doctors coming through training.
The other thing that's happening, and certainly within our service, is more and more of the triage is being done by extended scope physiotherapists.
Right.
So there's initially a process of paper triage where... a patient is referred in by their GP with a letter. The letter is assessed before the patient is even seen by an experienced paper triager, who's an extended scope physiotherapist, who can pick out the words and the signs from the doctor that a patient either needs to see a consultant surgeon. So if there are any red flags, for example, or indications that there might be red flags, those patients would see a spinal surgeon. But all of the other patients, the chronic and complex patients, are seen by extended scope physiotherapists.
Yeah.
And they're triaged by them. And the early indication seems to be that they're much better at doing it, because the vast majority of those patients won't need spinal surgery. Around about 90% of those patients won't need spinal surgery. And so to see a spinal surgeon who offers spinal surgery is perhaps not the best use of the surgeon's time, but it also doesn't deliver the best outcomes for the patient.
How good are the spinal surgeons at not recommending surgery when perhaps another route is available or more promising?
I think better and better for a couple of reasons. One is that the understanding of surgery improves all the time, but also, you know, nobody wants to subject a patient to an invasive procedure with the risks that are inherent to spinal surgery if it's not absolutely necessary.
The person who asked that last question has just said that clearly the MSK triage is better in Nottinghamshire, which is very reassuring.
Charlie Pears is an osteopath down in Plymouth, and he is part of an MSK triage service who deal with acute spinal pain and radiculopathies, and they do fantastically well. You know, there are pockets of really good MSK triage going on, and we have responsibility to make these models that we are developing available to the rest of the NHS community, and we're busy writing a paper at the moment about the model that Nottingham provides, so that hopefully other hospitals will look at it, not just from a cost-benefit analysis, but also from a clinical effectiveness point of view, and try and replicate it in their own hospitals.
I suspect that cost-benefit is going to be uppermost in their minds.
Yeah,
at the moment,
naturally it will be, but all the indications are, you know, that the cost-benefit analysis of having an ESP or an osteopath triaging non-surgical patients is plain, because we don't get paid as much as a spinal surgeon does. And also, if that spinal surgeon isn't sitting in clinic triaging non-surgical patients, they're in theatre operating on surgical patients, which is more lucrative to the service from that point of view. So it frees the surgeons up to do what they're best at doing and what only they can do, which, you know, needs to happen. But equally, it frees the non-surgical members of staff up to triage those patients and hopefully produce better outcomes clinically as well.
Right, so we're on the subject of... Before I go on, I'm not sort of idly tapping into my Facebook while we're talking here. The questions are coming in by courtesy of this iPad. We are reduced in size in our technical team today, and our usual highly sophisticated system of having Claire, my fellow osteopath, taking questions from a computer and then passing them to me on a card, can't operate, so I'm having to do it myself this evening. So if it all goes horribly wrong, I have myself to blame. But James, were you yesterday, I think, you gave a presentation to the spinal surgeons at your unit, did you not?
Yeah, it went well. We do it once a year.
You do it once a year?
Yes. So essentially what happens in our unit is we have 8 full-time consultant surgeons who are permanent members of staff within the Nottingham unit. But we also train every year. The unit trains up spinal surgeons from all around the world. So these are fellows who come into the, by fellows I mean surgical fellows rather than gentlemen fellows, who come into the service as qualified orthopedic surgeons and neurosurgeons who want to go on to become consultant spinal surgeons. Right. So they do a 2 or 3 year fellowship program where they exclusively operate on spines for that time to develop the skills necessary to become a consultant spinal surgeon. So what we have to do is, there's an annual turnaround of these fellows. So every year we present a teaching to them on how to make the most appropriate referrals to conservative medicine in the event that they triage a patient who's non-surgical.
So these are fellows whose expertise, whose desire, whose ambition is to chisel away at people's spines.
Yes.
How receptive are they to your presentation?
Very. They're very receptive because equally they are confronted by patients who they can't operate on an almost daily basis. And so, to provide them with a tool bag that they can use to make the most appropriate referral so that those patients aren't being siloed in lots of different channels where they get the wrong treatment and then they get siloed somewhere else for the wrong treatment. Yeah. So we don't turn subacute patients into chronic patients. So they love the fact that we give them some tips and some advice and some education on how to identify which patients should be going to which particular therapist.
And is this a presentation just by you, or is
so? Yesterday, I did the presentation with Ellie, who's our senior spinal physiotherapist. Yeah. So she looked at the referrals to physiotherapy and to our Nottingham back pain team, which provide a biopsychosocial management program.
Right.
And I presented the osteopathy component of it, along with service evaluation, talking about the evidence for manual therapy for neck and back pain. It's a fairly comprehensive one-hour teaching session with lots of information for them, and it stimulates a lot of discussion, a lot of debate, and you can see throughout the course of the hour where they start off sitting there with their arms folded, slightly slumped in their seats, thinking, I'm not quite sure how relevant this is to me, to by the end of the hour, they're sitting up, talking, engaging, interested, and...
To each other or to you?
Both. But often with eyebrows raised, because they don't realise what options are available to them when they're working in the spinal unit until we do this, which is why we do this teaching.
Yeah. So what in particular do you cover on the talk then?
So we look at the evidence for physiotherapy, we look at the evidence for manual therapy, specifically because we're a spinal unit, we look at it for back pain and neck pain.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the different types of patients, so patients who present with patho-anatomical conditions, and the patho-anatomical patients tend to need to go on to either surgery or injection therapy or pain management. So these are patients who have an anatomical derangement, which is the source of their pain. So whether it be disc bulges, stenosis, myelopaths, that sort of thing. So they're the patients who we don't tend to get involved in. They're patho-anatomical, they need to have surgery or injections or pain management. Then there are the patients who fall into the biopsychosocial model, who have significant psychological overlay. They're centrally sensitized, they're neuropathic. So their pain and their conditions don't particularly respond to a hands-on treatment or to an exercise-based treatment. And then there are the patients with the movement disorders who are the kind of osteophysio type patients. So we help them to identify the different types of patients. They obviously are good at the patho-anatomical patients anyway, but we help them to identify what a biopsychosocial patient looks like and what a movement disorder patient looks like. And then we break the movement disorder patients down into those that require physiotherapy, those that require osteopathy.
Okay.
And the other point that we emphasize to them is that many of the patients, because they are chronic, will have an overlap of biopsychosocial, patho-anatomical, and movement disorder. And that's when the skill becomes a little bit more difficult, but essentially it's trying to identify which is the primary driver for their symptoms. And if you can work out which is the primary driver for the symptoms, then you make the referral to the therapy that's most likely to benefit them.
There's an interesting point that's just come in. These surgeons are progressing towards their consultancy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that they are coming from all over the country rather than just from this area? So they could actually be surgeons going back into areas where we practice.
Well, probably of the 10 training surgeons that we have, we may have one or two who come from the Trent region. And we'll probably only have three or four who are British. So we have them coming from all over Europe, from India, from Australia, from America, from the Far East.
Yeah.
So it's a fabulous opportunity again for osteopathy to promote itself internationally, not just locally.
Yeah, somewhat disappointing for UK osteopaths or chiropractors or physios though, that there's only three from this country in each of these cohorts.
Yeah, it's an open application process again, and you know, there are a limited number of jobs in this country as spinal surgeons. Because it's a very specialist discipline, There aren't many hospitals in the country that offer spinal surgery as a specialist discipline. And so, you know, we don't want to be training too many spinal surgeons up in this country who are never going to find a job.
You've got this wonderful chart here of the sort of the pathway, the treatment pathway through your service. And it's come to my mind particularly as one of the questions relates to it. Do you want to talk through how that operates within the hospital? Then we can take out the individual items and talk about them.
Sure.
Okay. So if we can put that slide up, or at least partly bring that slide up. So the referral in here, the referral comes from whom?
So the referral comes from the GP, by and large.
Do you get direct referrals from physios or osteos?
No. Any referral coming into the spinal unit has to be triaged by either one of the ESPs or the spinal surgeons at the moment.
I meant to ask you about that. ESPs, extended scope practitioners, what constitutes ESP training? What makes them different from physio? What do they do?
So they are experienced physiotherapists for a start. Yes. And then they go through a training competency package, which is specifically, you know, it's based around spinal pathology. So they are specialised in identifying red flags, specialised in assessing patients, particularly from a neurological point of view, and specialised in recognising the kind of pathologies that present in a specialist spinal unit.
How long is that training?
I suspect it's about 6 months, although I don't know that for certain. But they're experienced physios who have worked within the spinal rotation prior to applying for an ESP role. But extended scope means exactly that they're extending their scope of practice. They're not learning anything new. They're just extending what they already know and developing their skills to a higher level.
I confess, with rather a red face, that for a long time I thought it meant that they'd been on a manipulation course. We could have done.
Some of them have been on manipulation or manual therapy courses. Because they're experienced physios, they will have done other things. But no, they primarily are trained to specifically carry out the extended role that they're going to perform within the trust.
Okay, so next stage, we've got triage in here, which you've talked about for a little while. What happens to them next? They're going to go into investigation or they're going to be discharged?
So when they're triaged, basically they're assessed. If the assessment process, the triage process, suggests that there may be something going on which hasn't as yet been identified, some underlying pathology, then they could be sent directly for further investigation, be that MRI, CT, x-rays, blood tests, EMG studies.
When you, again, apologies for interrupting, when you talked about disc bulges and so on earlier on, it suddenly sprang to mind, you know, there is that very old piece of wisdom that disc bulges don't necessarily represent the cause of a problem. So how do your spinal consultants or trainee consultants interpret their MRIs? How do they distinguish which ones should come back to manual therapy as opposed to surgery?
So there was a study done by Brinjitsky in 2014 which looked at the radiological evidence for spinal conditions and how that relates and correlates with symptomatic spines. And I'm trying to remember the figures off the top of my head, but roughly 30% of 20-year-olds will have a diagnosable radiological pathology, whether it be degeneration, herniation, protrusion, or annular tears. And that gradually increases, the incident gradually increases to 80-year-olds, where roughly 90% of them will have an identifiable pathology. So the first thing you don't want to do is treat the scan.
So they're looking for related symptoms.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have your scan, you have your patient in front of you. You know, do the radiological findings correlate with the examination findings? So you assess your patient, you carry out a neurological examination, and they may have ridiculous symptoms on their right leg, and yet when you look at the scan, the disc bulge is to the left. They've got a paracentral disc bulge impinging on the S1 nerve root, and yet they've got L5 nerve root symptoms on the right leg. Clearly the two things don't correspond, and so it's unlikely that the radiological findings explain the leg symptoms. So in that case, the surgeon would say, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. I don't think that this is a disc bulge pressing on a nerve. I think there is a disc bulge in the presence of ridiculous symptoms.
So on other occasions then, because logically on that basis, a person may have radicular symptoms and a disc bulge on the appropriate, on the relevant side, but it could still not be the disc bulge that's causing it.
Yep.
So will they sometimes say, well, let's go down a more conservative route first, rather than just say the symptoms correlate with the disc bulge, we'll treat surgically?
So they certainly wouldn't go to surgery as a first port of call. What they would do is, if somebody had radicular symptoms that corresponded with radiological findings, they would likely carry out a nerve root block.
Right.
Which would be an injection to anaesthetise that particular nerve root, done under fluoroscopic guidance, so they can be very clear that they've injected the anaesthetic and the steroid into the right place.
That's what you do.
That's one of the procedures that I do. Mm. And then if the patient responds favourably, then you've got some justification for saying, actually what we need to go in there is decompress that nerve, because it's clear that that nerve root is being irritated by a disc bulge. If, when you injected a nerve root and there was no change in radicular symptoms, even in the presence of a disc bulge, then again you would question whether the disc bulge is actually relevant in terms of that patient's symptoms.
So this is all still part of the investigation box on your chart here.
It can be, yes.
Which is then going to go to surgical management if they've proved that it's a surgical case, or to conservative management. And the first of the boxes on your list is orthotics.
Yes.
That's probably just coincidence that it's the first on the list rather than the most commonly tried.
So there is no particular order to those. That's just the way they came out of my head.
And that was one of these questions. The question that's just come in is, what about the use of orthotic insoles to stabilise or for rehab?
Or
the opposite, do they destabilise a joint?
So the orthotics department within our spinal unit is not an orthotics department as you might understand it in primary care. Our orthotists primarily are responsible for providing spinal braces in patients who've had fractures. Aspin collars, hard collars, TLSOs, which are thoracolumbar spinal orthoses, which is a big brace for thoracic fractures. So that's their primary role, is to provide those sorts of orthoses.
This is about foot orthotics, I see the difference,
But we do have orthotists who will provide foot orthotics if we or the physiotherapist feel that they're relevant and necessary.
Right.
So orthotics, in the sense that we're talking today, that could be anything from a cervical brace down to a shoe, a foot orthosis, depending on what the patient needs, but they fall under the conservative management remit.
Okay. Let me just see if there's anything we should talk about here. I think we've probably covered that one. So the next on your list is to go to biopsychosocial.
Yes.
Which, I guess about 4 or 5 years ago, seemed to become a bit of a buzz expression in the medical fraternity.
Yes.
But there's a lot of evidence behind the biopsychosocial concept, isn't there?
There is.
So how has it managed at Nottingham?
Well, there's a growing evidence, particularly for patients with chronic pain. As I said earlier, you'll have your patho-anatomicals, your biopsychosocials and your movement disorders, where the biopsychosocial component of that is the primary driver to their pain. We know from both our own experience and from published literature that managing those patients with manual therapy or exercise therapy is pointless. They don't get better, and in fact they get worse.
Yeah.
So what you have to try and do initially is go through a desensitization process if they're at that stage where you help them to understand their pain, and that's through educating them about pain science, the fact that pain doesn't necessarily mean damage, that pain doesn't necessarily mean something's going wrong, their spine isn't crumbling, their disc isn't bulging further. And once a patient has gone through that process and have come to terms with the fact that pain doesn't necessarily mean damage, then they can come back into an exercise-based or manual therapy-based treatment. We also have what's called level 4, which is for patients who have such significant pathology that their program is based more about acceptance. Acceptance of the fact that they have a chronic spinal condition which won't get better, and it's about them coming to terms with that. We have a what's called the Nottingham Back Pain Team, who deliver all of our biopsychosocial treatment, and that team is made up of physiotherapists, specialist nurses, and psychologists.
I think, and I apologize if I'm wrong about this, I should know, I think we recently uploaded a research review onto the website about biopsychosocial methods of addressing pain. And there were some very, very impressive statistics about how you can reduce pain levels by just informing a patient of what's going on, let alone other CBT approaches.
And it's a CBT big part of what we do. So CBT is available through the psychologists and the CBT therapists that we have. But a big part of what we do as osteopaths and our physiotherapy colleagues is about pain science education. So the 10 to 12 courses of sessions of treatment that the patient has, we don't often get to talk about where they're going on holiday or what they had for dinner the night before. We spend a lot of time talking to them about pain science so that they can grasp the concept of pain science, because it's quite difficult. So we talk about things like tagging and smudging and all the bits that we may come on to talk about tonight, which help the patients to understand that why they feel what they feel as pain doesn't necessarily relate to spinal damage.
Well, I said good then with a slightly startled look on my face, because actually I don't remember that being part of our basic training as osteopaths. No. And maybe I should point out that James and I actually trained together. So could you take us through that a little bit? I mean, it might be a bit of a digression. We can come back in a second to the chart.
Yeah, so what we know about patients who have central sensitization is that they're their nervous system is almost ramped up, it's amplified, so that they're much more sensitized to pain.
As I understand it, the concept is that if you raise that sensitization in the central system, pain signals that would otherwise have been ignored by the brain are no longer ignored because they've triggered the threshold for
precisely that, which is why it's called central sensitization. Yeah. Your central nervous system has become sensitized, so you're much more hyperalgesic. Yeah. So if I were to pinch the skin now, I'd be aware that I've pinched, but it doesn't bother me much. If I had central sensitization and I pinched the skin, that I would feel that as an intense pain, which wouldn't just be where I pinched it, but it would spread around the body, and that's what's called the smudging effect.
Right.
So in the brain, the parts of the body are represented in different parts of the brain, so I know without looking, if I pinch my finger, I know which part of my finger I'm pinching on which hand, because my brain recognises that.
But if you smudge it, you're less focused on where that actual
stimulus... With chronic pain, what happens is that that area that is clearly defined as my finger becomes more diffuse. Yeah. So even though I pinch my finger, I can feel the pain across my whole hand, up into my elbow, up into my shoulder, into my neck. That's the smudging effect.
It's actually a hard concept to... you can understand it, but it's hard to accept in some ways, isn't it? Even for a trained practitioner like ourselves, and for a patient to understand that, that must take quite a lot of explaining.
And that's why you have 10 weeks, and you start early on within the treatment cycle, explaining about pain science, smudging and tagging. Tagging is effectively association. So we've all heard the stories of patients who say, you know, every morning I get out of bed, I bend over to put my socks on, and my back hurts. But if I go on holiday in a nice warm country, I bend over, get out of bed, bend over to put my socks on, and I don't feel any pain in my back at all, and it's because it's a lovely warm country. Mm. It's probably not that. It's probably more to do with the fact that they're in a different place. They're not sitting on the same side of the bed, in the same bedroom, in the same environment, where their brain has learned to associate. Bending over in those, all those associated factors are associated with the pain. It's almost Pavlovian, if you like. Yeah. So they go to a different environment, they sit in a different room on a different bed and feel different about where they are.
And go away very disappointed that the NHS won't prescribe holidays in Barbados.
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
But for a long time we thought it was because it was warmer weather, or because they were more relaxed, or because they were eating different food. It's more likely to be tagging, that they're no longer associating their pain with the particular environment that they're in.
I did hear once of a patient who was adamant that her back pain had been caused by eating oranges in the bath. We struggle.
One wonders why one eats oranges in the bath in the first place.
Well,
it's not something
that,
I would do.
I want to deal with this question because there are others coming in, and it goes back to your 12-week treatment process. Mm. Because of the complexity of chronic spinal conditions, do you ever instigate a maintenance program of treatments after your course of 10 to 12? So are there further treatments rather than just an exercise program?
This is an interesting question, and it's certainly one that comes up regularly, certainly with our surgical colleagues. You know, what happens to these patients? I think part of the answer to that is A, that we need to change our mindset with regards to chronic pain, chronic spinal pain. If a patient were diagnosed with a chronic condition like diabetes or a thyroid problem or a renal problem, we wouldn't expect them to come in, have a shot of insulin, walk out the door, and that'd be the end of it. We know that they need some kind of ongoing care and maintenance program.
Yeah.
And back pain is no different. It's a chronic condition which we don't essentially cure, we just find a way of effectively managing it. So So what we know from our particular patient group is that some of them we are able to treat, and primarily where the biggest dominant driving feature is a movement disorder, we can generally treat them and discharge them and they go away and we don't have to see them again. Where they have...
What do you define as a movement disorder? Your observation that there's a spinal segment that doesn't move fluidly?
Yeah, so it can either be a local, an L5-S1, or a cervicothoracic problem where they don't move particularly well, or it can be more global. In other words, they're very stiff. Mm-hmm. You know, their lumbar spine or thoracolumbar spine has become very stiff. If it's purely mechanical and you're able to resolve that, those patients go away and they're generally, with a bit of advice and a bit of information, go away and we don't need to see them again. Yeah. If they've got a predominantly biopsychosocial problem, they generally will need more treatment. They become more dependent on treatment.
Yes.
They like having treatment because they feel better, and they become a little bit dependent on the treatment process, and that's part of the whole biopsychosocial issue. If they have a patho-anatomical problem, so for example, our patients with adolescent idiopathic scoliosis or degenerative scoliosis or stenosis, who we are able to do well with, we're effectively neuromodulating. What the treatment is doing is downgrading their pain and giving them a period of time where they're functionally better and their pain levels are better.
Yeah.
But we know that they have an anatomical pathology, which means that the problem hasn't gone away. We've just neuromodulated them, and they will need ongoing care. Unfortunately, our service is just too overwhelmed to be able to provide that ongoing care. So what we're looking to do now is establish community-based care programs where these patients can go away and see osteopathy in the community or physiotherapists in the community who can deliver little bite-sized chunks of treatment to keep those patients moving forward.
But who pays for that? The patient?
Well, at the moment, the patient. Mm. But what we're currently going through is a process of negotiating with CCGs yes. and providers and commissioners to try and get them to buy into this idea that back pain, chronic back pain, is a chronic condition which needs managing, as all chronic conditions do, and that it's more cost-effective once we've had our 12 sessions of treatment and got those patients back to work, off their medication, managing activities of normal daily living. It's more cost effective every now and then to provide them with a short burst of treatment which helps to maintain their progress than it is to just allow them to deteriorate to the point where they then get referred back into our service and need a further 12 treatments. And that's for two reasons. One is because those patients end up consuming a lot of time from their GP, a lot of medication, a lot of our treatment, but also because delivering the kind of care we do in a secondary care unit is hugely expensive compared with delivering it in primary care. So if we can get those patients out into primary care and seen by osteopaths and physios in the community, it's a much more cost-effective way of doing it than it is to have them seeing us in
you excluded chiropractors at that point. Is that because they're simply not part of the spinal unit, or is there a...
Yes, probably. I have no prejudice to chiropractors. Yeah. You know, there are chiropractors who are very capable and competent of delivering the same sort of care that we are. In the same way, there are osteopaths who aren't, and there are physiotherapists who aren't. So I don't exclude them for any other reason. I just didn't say that.
Yeah. I think I like to think that one of the benefits of what we're doing here is that we're trying to encourage more chiropractors and physiotherapists to join, try and break down some of the, I don't know, institutional boundaries between us.
Yeah.
A question about something you were saying a moment ago. In your unit, what constitutes a scoliosis? Is it purely if you can relate that deformity to pain, or is there a degree of scoliosis at which point it becomes, is given that formal title?
It's a radiological identification of a curvature, of a lateral curvature.
But it doesn't matter how much, because, you know...
No, so it would be a mild, moderate or severe scoliosis. Okay.
And is it definable for us in clinic? If we see one in clinic, would we be able to say to a GP, mild, moderate or severe, dependent on specific factors?
There are all sorts of classifications. There's what's known as the Lenke classification system, which talks about, you know, A, B, C, D, E and F curves, and major lumbar and minor thoracic. And so they're a vast number. I don't think that's particularly necessary or relevant for us in private practice.
Would it be under those terms, not necessarily those terms, but would the terms mild, moderate, severe scoliosis be properly understood by a GP if we sent them back?
Yes. Right. So if a patient had a slight curvature which was identifiable visibly, If you referred that patient to a GP and said, I suspect a mild scoliosis, if the patient had a more significant scoliosis, and this would be more likely in a patient who had either an adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, so in a young teenage, up to mid-teenage boy or girl, or with an older patient who had developed a degenerative scoliosis because of facet joint hypertrophy, that would be, again, if you said to the patient, the GP or whoever you're referring the patient to, that they had a moderate or severe scoliosis, that would be understood as that. But I don't think there are hard definitions, you know.
I suppose the reason I pursued that slightly is because I can remember during training and talking to osteopaths since, and even in my current clinic with my fellow osteopaths, you know, even a tiny little curve is regarded as a scoliosis when I suspect that in most cases, you know, it's not significant in terms of the patient's well-being.
But often they're not. So, yeah, and particularly a mild scoliosis often isn't relevant.
Yeah.
But it depends on the age of the patient.
Yes.
So if it's a young child or a teenager who's developing a scoliosis, that's certainly something which needs fairly quickly to be investigated because if it's an unstable scoliosis, there is a period of time in which that's amenable to correction. And beyond that, it becomes much more difficult to correct. So, you know, if you suspect a scoliosis in a teenager, it's certainly not the sort of thing that you ought to be thinking, well, I'll manage this myself and see how we go. However, in an adult who you suspected as having a degenerative scoliosis, you certainly could manage them as long as they don't have any neurological symptoms going along with those.
Or any signs of worsening, presumably.
Yes. Yeah. So again, you know, an adult with degenerative scoliosis will be operated on if the scoliosis is causing neurological symptoms. They wouldn't generally be operated on simply for back pain.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to ask a question from one of our viewers at the moment who says, sorry for the typos, so apologies for the typos it's in what I say at the moment. Do you use Lorimer Moseley's book for patients? Do you know of Lorimer Moseley's book?
I do, and I think it's a good resource. Yeah. I draw from all sorts of texts and references and colleagues and wherever else I can get information from, but I am aware of it and it is something I'm familiar with. Yeah.
Is that something we should all be familiar with and have in our clinics?
I think we should all be familiar with as much as we possibly can. Yeah. You know, I think standard assessment of patients, that's one of the things we ought to be able to do as a profession, is to be able to standardise how we assess patients so that we can communicate with one another and with other professions and know that there's this consistency in the way that we communicate and what we're communicating.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite useful to have that sort of knowledge and experience shared. So if you don't have a question, but you've got some observations from your own practice, then you know, please send those in, because this is a great opportunity for us to pass that knowledge on to the actually quite large number of osteopaths and others who are watching this evening. We have some more questions as well, James, so it's before you move on to your next stage. I think this one, I think you have answered. I mean, what do surgeons think about patients having community or private treatments? I mean, I guess most of them don't mind their private practices of their own in many cases.
The experience that I have of our surgical colleagues is that they certainly don't sit there tutting. I think there's a recognition that spinal pain is difficult to manage. It's not an easy area of the body to manage, and spinal pain is, particularly chronic spinal pain, is difficult.
Yeah.
And if somebody in the community is able to help a patient, even for a limited period of time, I don't think any surgeon or any medic or GP or physio would have an issue with that. I think the issue that they have is when patients have a long course of treatment with no benefit, or when there are signs and symptoms indicative of underlying pathology and those patients aren't referred on. I think that's when people have an issue, and justifiably so.
There's an issue in our own minds, though, isn't there? Because I don't suspect that I am unusual in that I want my patients to get better quickly. And if I've got a referral from a GP, I'm particularly concerned they get better quickly because I want to show that GP that we're really good at our jobs. But actually, GPs are used to patients not getting instant relief, and your spinal surgeons will know that it can't be done overnight. And it's helpful if we bear that in mind in dealing with GPs, because they don't want to see no relief, no effect at all, but they are prepared to wait for a while, and they're also prepared to accept that maybe it doesn't work and say, okay, we've tried that route, now let's try a different route.
Yeah, because they're all, you'd like to think that they're pragmatists.
Yes.
And we all, you know, my surgical colleagues, my physician colleagues, GPs, physios, we've all had patients who we can't get better. And it's not because we're not good at what we do. It's not good because we haven't applied the right sort of treatment. It's because sometimes patients don't get better for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
And I don't know that a medical colleague would ever turn around and castigate you for having tried to treat somebody as long as the treatment was appropriate and it was well delivered and it was timely. And at the end of a series of, say, 4 or 5 treatments, saying, you know, we're not getting anywhere with this. I think we need to investigate it further, or we need to try a different sort of treatment, or we need to maybe look at some medication.
Yeah.
I think the problem is when patients have a lot of ongoing treatment where there's no sign of any improvement, or where worrying symptoms are ignored or not identified.
Yeah. There was a long question that just came in, which has just disappeared. So I won't talk about that. But, let's move to your continuing through your treatment pathway here. After biopsychosocial, we've got physiotherapy and osteopathy, and I think you probably covered in outline how they might distinguish which one they would send them to, or is that less obvious than I would think? Do you and the physios decide between you who is the most appropriate person, or whether it should be a joint effort?
No, I think we have an understanding of what one another does well. We certainly don't sit over each patient referral and say who fancies this one. It's more a case of, you know, whoever's doing the triage has a pretty good understanding of what physios manage well and of what osteopaths manage well. But then there are a number of other factors which have to be considered in that decision. You know, if a patient has had a lot of physiotherapy before they've arrived, there's very little point in sending them for even more physiotherapy, particularly if the physio they've had is of a reasonable standard and with a good physio. So that patient almost certainly wouldn't be offered more physiotherapy. They'd be offered some other intervention and more likely osteopathy.
Yeah. Okay.
Similarly, if a patient has had a lot of osteopathy from a good osteopath who's done seemingly, you know, reasonable treatment, there's no point in referring them to us for yet more osteopathy treatment. There's also an element of patient's beliefs. You know, does a patient believe that physiotherapy is a good way for them to go, or osteopathy is a good way to go? Because if a patient believes they're likely to get better with a particular therapist, they're more likely to do well.
Yeah.
So it's about what treatment they've had, what their expectations are, what their belief system is. And then, you know, sometimes it's a toss of a coin, really. Is this physio or osteopath? And then you start to rely on more experience and what you've seen work and what you've seen fail.
Okay. You've got injection therapy as an option on your list as well here. Now, you also mentioned that as a diagnostic tool. Here, this is for as a remedial method.
It can be both. It can be a diagnostic tool. So we offer a range of diagnostic injections, mainly facet joint injections, sacroiliac joint injections, or nerve root blocks. So they tend to be what we call blocks. So you block what you think is the source of the pain. If you get the result that you expected to get, then you know that is the source of your pain, and then that informs your management of those patients.
As opposed to sacroiliac, which will be anti-inflammatory? Or
Sometimes patients with sacroiliac joint pain have had manual therapy and it just exacerbates their symptoms, or they haven't had any manual therapy, but they're too acute to treat.
Okay.
A sacroiliac joint block can sometimes be useful in buying a window of opportunity to then get into some manual therapy or physiotherapy, or to identify the next step forward, which may well be a denervation procedure.
What are you actually injecting into in the sacroiliac joint?
It's a combination of a long-acting steroid, triamcinolone, and a long-acting anesthetic, bupivacaine.
Right. We've got on the bottom of your list watchful wait, James, which I always think is a very hard one with patients, particularly in private practice where they're paying, to be able to say to a patient, you know, well, we're not going to do anything with you, we're just going to, in watchful wait to me, also I think that sounds very woolly. There are other ways of saying the same thing, I'm sure. In fact, we discussed this with Pippa Bark a few weeks ago when we discussed informed consent. Not so much the terminology, but the fact that if you express it correctly, a watchful wait can come across as a good thing for somebody who you don't
absolutely
want to.
Absolutely. And I think a patient would respect you more if you said, you know, I think at the moment what we need to just do is step back and see what happens with this. Because sometimes, particularly back pain, tends to follow a natural course towards improvement.
Yeah.
And this is
yeah.
something that's often worth communicating to patients. One is the structural strength and integrity of the spine. Two is the natural tendency for most back conditions to get better anyway.
Yes.
So I don't think watchful wait is necessarily a negative thing. It can be a positive thing. For us, it has. There's a broader aspect to it as well, in that often patients who come to our service rather than necessarily to us as osteopaths have a degenerative condition, a degenerative process going on, like myelopathy, for example, where they're starting to show early signs of myelopathy, but it hasn't reached the stage where they perhaps need surgery. And rather than rushing into a surgical procedure, the surgeon or whoever's doing the triage will say, you know, what we'll do is follow you up every 3 months, carry out the same tests, see whether your condition is deteriorating. That would also fall under the watchful rate, weight remit.
Yes, it's harder in a private clinic to say that, isn't it? Say, well, I'm going to get you back in 3 months and have another chat with you, and I may or may not treat you, but I'm going to give you some advice.
I certainly do that with some of my patients who, if I've treated them and they've had a successful course of treatment, and I say, right, what we're going to do now is I'm going to leave you alone for 3 months or six months, and I want you to come back, partly so that I can reassure you that when you come back, if anything is starting to go awry, we can nip it in the bud and deal with it soon. But also that they know that they're not just being sent out and that's the end of it. They've got to go manage it by themselves, but they have an option to come back if they so choose. But I always add the caveat to the watchful wait, is that if they're fine and they're coping well and they're not having any problems, by all means cancel their appointment. They don't need to come back.
Another question. You mentioned earlier on that 43% of patients stop their medication after treatment. Who decides that? Can you tell them to stop their medication, or do they have to go back to their GP or surgeon to be told that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because we're not prescribers, but we are in an environment where we can discuss patients with prescribing colleagues. But most often we will write to the GPs. The way we communicate with every patient's GPs, and we do communicate with every patient's GP, is at the beginning when they come in for an assessment, we write to the GP and explain what we've found, what we think is going on, and how we intend to manage the condition. And then at the end of the course of treatment, we'll communicate with the GP again by letter, saying what the outcomes of treatment are, how the patient's responded, and what the future management plan is. And within that, we may well talk about reducing medications or changing medications, because again, we deal with a very small and specific range of medications which are relevant to back pain. So opioids, anticonvulsants, anti-inflammatories, those sorts of things, tricyclics. And so we're able to say to the patient, you know, we think possibly the patient needs to move away from opioids, particularly with chronic pain, they ought to be moving away from opioids and more towards neuroleptic drugs like gabapentin, pregabalin, that sort of thing. So we will often communicate that with a GP, but we'll say to the patient, start to decrease your medication, because we have experience of dealing with these types of medications and how to manage them.
Right, okay, but that's not something you expect a conventional osteopath, physio to do in their own private practice without a pretty firm agreement with the GP.
I would do that with great caution, but I think you would have a lot more respect again from a GP if you said to the GP, you know, the patient is doing better and we're considering reducing their codeine or morphine or whatever medication they were opioid they're taking, or if you have a patient who has neuropathic symptoms and you think that they could do with something like amitriptyline or a pregabalin or a gabapentin or a duloxetine, you know, discuss that with the GP if you have an understanding of what it is that you're talking about, or just say to the patient, you know, to the GP, I think the patient has some neuropathic symptoms and they could do with some medication to help manage that.
A comment. I suspected that a patient had PMR. The patient's waiting for blood tests, but the GP wants to refer this patient for physiotherapy.
Yeah, and that's often the case, and it's one of the frustrations of being an osteopath in primary care is that and I think it's perhaps one of the reasons why we're sometimes less quick to refer patients to their GP for investigation than we might otherwise be. It's a difficult question to answer, because I think that whoever sent that comment in is probably right, that we may well lose the patient. PMR is a difficult one anyway, because it's probably best managed with steroids because of the associated risks with giant cell arteritis, temporal arteritis.
Which is obviously the questioner's concern, that this doesn't merit physio.
But the primary responsibility of the osteopath or the referrer, whether it be osteopath, chiropractor, physio, is to make sure that the patient is assessed, because if they do have temporal arteritis, they need steroids.
It's very hard to do, though, isn't it? I mean, you can suggest, you can put in the key words in your letter to a GP, but you can't make the GP go down any particular route, and that's perfectly right that we shouldn't.
I don't know, if you feel pretty strongly about it. I mean, I've certainly referred patients to GPs with a query, cervical myelopathy, and the GPs poo-pooed the diagnosis and batted it back. And I've phoned the GP up and said, you know, I think this needs to be investigated. I don't think you can simply dismiss it as shoulder pain and arm pain. The patient has positive Hoffman's, they have brisk reflexes, this is something that needs to be investigated. Yeah. And certainly whenever I've had to call a GP and emphasize the importance of an onward referral, they've never said no.
No, I'm very fond of telling people about my one quarter equina patient who I referred to the A&E unit at our local hospital. The patient was incontinent, had low back pain. You know, I mean, there wasn't anything I was going to do with this patient, so I sent him straight to A&E where he was discharged with anti-inflammatories. Mm. There's not much I could do about that other than say you need a second opinion. And he went to see his GP, who called an ambulance and sent him straight to a neurological. Yeah.
Did the right thing. And thank you. What more can you do other than do the right thing?
It's disconcerting, isn't it, when you think you've shown that you understand the situation, you've put in all the key words, and yet still your suggestion, your advice could be ignored.
Sorry, I was going to say, certainly again from experience of quadra equina patients coming into the hospital. Is our chaps would much rather see 100 query quarter equiners or impending quarter equiners and discharge them than not see the one who isn't diagnosed and who ends up with lifelong disability as a result.
And there is a very good research review up on the website, at least I think it's very good, about just that, assessing quarter equiner problems. So by all means, feel free to go and have a look at that. Prescribing drugs, I mean, we touched on it earlier on. What about, why shouldn't osteopaths train to prescribe drugs? Where do you stand on this dilemma?
My opinion, there is absolutely no reason why we shouldn't. Mm. I think there are a limited range of drugs and there's limited scope for their prescription. Mm. But there are times, and again, this may not sound particularly osteopathic, but there are times where medication is the most appropriate and the most effective treatment for a patient with spinal pain, and you know, we ought to, I think, be able to prescribe where appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree that there is a very, very fundamentalist school of osteopathy that says drugs are bad and we shouldn't do that. There should always be another approach. But I don't think it should be excluded to us.
And that's fine. For those osteopaths who choose to practice that way, that's absolutely fine. In the same way that osteopaths who believe that there is scope for prescription and there are occasions, you know, we have to be pragmatic about it. We can be very principled about what we like and don't like, but at the end of the day, if you have a patient in front of you who has no option but to take medication, you know, we may well at that particular point be best placed to prescribe the right medication.
If nothing else, it cuts down the process, doesn't it? If you say to a patient, no, I think you need some anti-inflammatory, some drugs, go and make an appointment with your GP, that could be another 2 weeks for the patient, which isn't good client management.
Yeah, and they could get to the GP who may disagree with your assessment and prescribe the wrong medication. And there's a huge problem, certainly in this country at the moment, with over-prescription of opioids to patients with chronic back pain. And the evidence is that they do nothing for patients with chronic pain. The patients have a phenomenally high associated comorbidities through taking long-term opioids. And you know, ultimately, there's going to be a trend of moving away from the likes of codeine and morphine and the fentanyl patches and Butrans patches and all the other sorts of transdermal patches that are being prescribed, because the evidence is dictating that's the way prescription needs to go.
It shouldn't be a trend, should it really? It should be, God, we've found this out, we should stop doing it. It'll take some time to infiltrate.
Prescribing habits take a long time to change. Yeah.
A question from one of our viewers. Referring back to talking about scoliosis, what would be considered best practice for an exaggerated thoracic kyphosis in management and treatment? And I have to say at this point, you don't have to get the answer from James, because James isn't the world expert on all these conditions. No. If other people have observations on this, then please tell us what you think. So treating an exaggerated thoracic kyphosis, for example, a female 30 plus with an obvious thoracic kyphosis that is symptomatic or asymptomatic but has concerns about their posture in the long term. It's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, again, I suppose it depends what we mean by an exaggerated thoracic kyphosis. If it's a gentle sloping kyphosis, which in a 30-year-old should be reasonably mobile and should be able to be corrected with exercise and hands-on treatment, I wouldn't be too concerned about managing it. If there was a more significant kyphosis which felt pretty rigid or was associated with pain, particularly localized pain, then you have to question whether there's been some sort of collapse within the thorax, you know, so vertebral collapse because of either a lytic lesion or osteoporotic lesion. Those are the sorts of things that I would very quickly refer on.
And I suppose in the asymptomatic patient, you'd be looking for changes, wouldn't you?
Yeah, or there's a Sherman's kyphosis, you know, you may want to refer the patient on for a radiological examination to establish whether there is a Sherman's. And if, you know, there are a number of reasons why people are kyphotic. It could just be poor posture, it could just be hereditary posture, it could be that the patient is, you know, in an occupation where they spend a lot of time bent forwards, but it should be the kind of thing which, in the absence of any other alarming symptoms, is correctable with some treatment.
Do you think we're ever a little bit too optimistic in our aspirations to change people's postural habits and patterns?
Yeah, I think posture is a really difficult thing because, by definition, posture is something you don't think about. It's something you do. Yes. I mean, I'm not sitting particularly well myself. I think it's about managing expectations. I think we have to be realistic with patients. And you know, when a patient has been to you once or twice, you get a sense of what sort of patient they are. And there are what I call the 100%ers, that if you ask them to walk out of your clinic and under a bus, they would do it. And there are other people, if you gave them one or two really small exercises which lasted 30 seconds a day, they wouldn't do it. And patients fall, you know, somewhere in between those two extremes. I haven't as yet had anybody walk under a bus, fortunately.
Only because you didn't tell them to.
Possibly. Yeah. But I think the point is about trying to judge the patient and what's right for them. Yeah. And if a patient has poor posture and isn't particularly involved or engaged or compliant in exercise programs, then really you're wasting your time trying to get them to do them.
Yeah. James, we have got about 10 minutes left. Have we covered everything that you wanted to talk about from your talk to the GP?
So the only thing we didn't cover off on there was that our pain management service. Here in Nottingham, we have a dedicated pain management service, which is run by a team of pain management consultants who are consultant anaesthetists by training, but who then go on to develop a special interest in pain management. And I would guess that it's probably one of the fastest growing disciplines in the NHS at the moment. For all sorts of reasons, we have a burgeoning community of chronic pain sufferers. Partly iatrogenic chronic pains, pain that's been caused through medical intervention, where it's an unfortunate or unforeseen consequence of a medical intervention.
It's not negligence.
It's just not negligence. It's just one of the complications of a procedure that they may have had, or because we're living longer, and you know, so chronic pain becomes more of a feature of getting old. Or because patients have higher expectations of pain these days, or being able to manage pain. And perhaps three or four generations ago, having back pain was part of getting older, and people just saw it as part and parcel of the aging process. I think
Three or four generations ago, I imagine they were far less sedentary. So there would be some degree of, whether you believe in core stability as being a remedy for back pain, there would have been some exercise going on in people's lives to a greater degree than there is now.
Because, they would.
You know, and every day I think, how long have I spent at my desk and how much time have I actually spent standing up, let alone walking around?
But equally, there will have been agricultural workers or miners who would have had chronic pain from their occupational factors as well, but they would have, you know, kind of shrugged their shoulders, accepted that chronic pain is part of getting older. But I think
and
that's changing.
We live longer too.
We do live longer.
There's a greater opportunity for pain to raise its head.
So there's a growing community of patients with chronic pain who want something to be done about it if possible. And there are a growing number of options available to them. We talked earlier about injection therapies. So if patients had chronic spinal pain which wasn't amenable to surgery, or the patient wasn't well enough to have spinal surgery, they can be managed with epidural injections, with radiofrequency ablation, which is something we touched on on the podcast thing that we did a few months ago, nerve root block injections. There are a growing number of medications which are available. We talked again about the anticonvulsant medications like gabapentin and pregabalin. The duloxetine is another medication which has been used more and more, as well as the opioids, and other anti-inflammatory drugs which are available now. So the pain management team is a growing team with a growing patient list, but through our interactions with them, they are recognizing more and more opportunity to send patients to us who probably wrongly have ended up in a pain management service. Because the pain management service is designed for patients who have unremediable, if that's a word, chronic pain. And certainly our consultants within our service are getting better and better at recognizing patients who have remedial conditions and when to refer them on to us. And whether that's chronic pelvic pain, chronic spinal pain, coccydynia, neck pain, all of those sorts of conditions are being referred to us now.
Excellent. I mean, I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch Stephen Sander's presentation.
I did. And Stephen Sander is the man who informed our coccydynia service. So
it was an excellent presentation.
Yes, very good.
And we didn't actually get any feedback from anybody who suggested they might like to attend a course with Stephen Sander so they could become competent and expert in dealing with coccydynia. But it's still something. If you're interested in that sort of thing, let us know. We'll try and arrange it for you. Two things we're going to cover before we finish, James. One is a question raised by one of the people for whom we've effectively laid on tonight's broadcast, and that is, doesn't that make your hands hurt doing osteopathy, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So what are the opportunities? How can we get some relief from that? What should we be doing instead?
I think it's a problem. I certainly have a history of hand, shoulder, elbow, neck pain from doing what we do. I think there's, directly in terms of what we do as osteopaths, we have to be aware of our own posture and our own use of our hands. You know, how do you spend less time doing it? I suppose I'm fortunate that I have a role which I do. There's a component of research involved in my role at the Queen's. So I have some time away where I'm not treating patients.
And except for the fact you said that now that you're doing 2 days up there, you're having to cram 5 days worth of patients into 3 days in your practice, so you're actually still treating the same number of patients.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But I also have an injection list, which takes me for an afternoon a week away from treating patients, and all I'm doing is squeezing syringes and being exposed to radiation. So it'll probably, if my hands don't get me, the radiation will.
Something to look forward to.
I think teaching and educating is something, again, I don't think it's valued enough amongst osteopaths, but... If you're an experienced osteopath with something to teach, something to give back to up and coming or graduating osteopaths, I think that's a really worthy and rewarding way of resting your hands and still using your brain.
Yeah. And the final question was about research, because you and I discussed earlier on the state of the approach to evidence-based medicine these days. I mean, how do you see that changing at the moment?
There was an article in the BMJ a few months ago about the evidence-based movement in crisis, and I'm not sure that I necessarily agreed with that. I don't think the evidence-based movement is in crisis, because I still think we have to move towards practicing evidence-based medicine.
Or trying to,
and it's difficult. But I think the problem is that there have been some abuses of the evidence-based medicine approach, where people have falsified outcomes or where people have manipulated statistics to tell a story which probably doesn't reflect the truth of the research.
Or consciously or subconsciously or both?
Both, I suspect. And I think there are also instances where evidence-based research has been buried because it doesn't find what's...
Well, that's a common allegation about the pharmaceutical industry, isn't it? That you only report the findings that support what you want them to support. And of course their drivers are much stronger than ours, because there are millions of pounds involved.
And there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure on researchers who are funded by their paymasters to produce a body of evidence which supports a particular product, albeit a pharmaceutical product or a surgical product. Yeah. And there is a lot of pressure to find for those particular drugs or pharmaceutical interventions. So I think, we have to be careful about not confusing evidence-based research with abuse of evidence-based research, and we don't want to be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think there is still a strong justification and argument for evidence-based medicine, but it has to be good evidence-based medicine. And certainly what we're doing and what we're focusing on at the Queen's is using a registry to compile a database of interventions, osteopathic interventions, which we can analyze and evaluate and learn what we do well and what we don't do well, and which patients benefit from our treatments and which ones don't, and to try and inform our practice in the best way that we can based on what we've been doing.
Yeah. And do you work closely with NCORE, which is the National Council for Osteopathic Research?
I've had a lot to do with NCORE. They're a fantastic resource in terms of helping us to set up research studies and to help us learn how to research, because it's not an easy thing to do, but also how to interpret research, because you know, if we are going to practice evidence-based medicine, we need to understand what good research looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, we have, I think, come to the end of our scheduled 90 minutes. I think, James, you and I at the start of this, we were thinking, well, gosh, will we get enough questions? Have we got enough to talk about in what's effectively an open forum? It's passed very quickly from
my
perspective.
We could go on.
We could go on, yeah. And that would probably be beneficial for, I know there's at least one person watching who's got 6 hours CPD to acquire before the end of the month.
Good luck.
Yeah, I do wish you the best of luck, and I wish we could provide that CPD, but 6 hours is, I'm afraid, beyond our capability. Hey, we are doing one thing, which I hope you've seen on some of our recent messages. Hasn't been made known to non-members yet. But as you can tell, we have quite a bit of video and recording technology and expertise behind us in the Academy. And we have mentioned, certainly if you watched today's APM TV, we've mentioned the importance of getting video onto websites. If you, as a member, would like us to produce a video for you, that is, stick you up against a green screen or a background like this or in the open air, give you a teleprompt, and film you for your website, we are quite happy to do that. We will do that, we'll do the editing, we'll produce the code, we'll give you the code, and all you have to do is put that on your website. There's a bit of a catch. We can only do it if you come to us when we're running one of our courses. So you have to kind of have to be on one of the courses. That's not just me trying to recruit for the courses, but it's just that we need to have you on hand so that we can do the filming. But it's a pretty generous offer, I think you'll agree, because to get it done professionally would cost you a lot of money elsewhere. We're doing it because we think it's important and because we've got that technology at our disposal. If you're interested, let me know. There are some courses coming up which are filling up rapidly, but there are still some places if you'd like to be on them. That is the end of this evening's broadcast. Thank you all for attending. I hope you've enjoyed it. I think it's been really valuable. The text summary and the recording will go up on the website very shortly. Next week, as I mentioned at the outset, we are coming to you from Tel Aviv, where I'm assured it will be nice and warm. And we're talking to Simeon Neil Asher, and we're going to be talking about intercostal pain and the use of trigger points to address that, possibly amongst other things as well. Anyway, thank you for watching. That's it from us, and good night.